A big cow's thanks goes out to Heidi at ShipShapeSystems.com for her support of Community Radio. Heidi works to help clients bring body, mind, and spirit in harmony using a process called conscious connected breathing. To find out more about her service, you can use ShipShapeSystems.com.
We thank Mac Daddy Repairs for their ongoing support. They're a West County computer and phone repair center featuring on-site and remote support. They're located at 301 North Main Street in Sebastopol and can be reached by email at support@macdaddyrepairs.com or by phone at 707-861-9403.
This song's about this good friend of mine named Rex Bell, who used to own half this place. It's called Rex's Blues. If you cut cards with Rex and you get a three, he'll get a two, you know what I mean? Ride the blue wind high and free. She'll lead you down through misery. Leave you low, come time to go. Alone and low as low can be. Well, if I had a nickel, I'd find a game. If I won a dollar, I'd make it rain. If it rained an ocean, I'd drink it dry and lay me down dissatisfied. It's legs to walk and thoughts to fly, eyes to laugh and lips to cry, a restless tongue to classify, all born to grow and grown to die. Tell my baby I said so long. Tell my mother I did no wrong. Tell my brother to watch his own. And tell my friends to mourn me none. I'm chained upon the face of time, feeling full of foolish rhyme. There ain't no dark till something shines. I'm bound to leave the dark behind. We'll ride the blue wind high and free. She'll lead you down through misery. Leave you low, come time to go. Alone and low as low can be. Alone and low as low can be.
She was born in 1774 in the province of New York in British America, and her earthly life would last for only 47 years. Hundreds of years later, Elizabeth Ann Bailey Seton would be canonized, the first saint to have been born in the New World. In the brief span of her life, she would found the American parochial school system, that institution which one day, far in an unimagined future, a frustrated nun at St. Vincent's Parochial School in Mission Hills in San Diego, California, would deny John Brockley's mentally disabled sister the sacrament for want of her ability to remember some words, which might invite one to wonder what counts as heresy, a disavowal of God or the abandonment of compassion. Welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. As always, if you're just joining us, I would encourage you to go back and start from the beginning of this Shaggy Dog story about God, life, and some statues and sculptures in a church in San Diego. I think we're 8 episodes in by now. And regardless, I really hope you have some time today, because today we'll be talking about not only heresy, but time itself. 200 years after Elizabeth Bailey Ann Seton's death, churches would be established around the country in St. Elizabeth's name. One would be in Carlsbad, California. The first years were pretty rocky. Masses were held in living rooms, money was found, the Catholic Diocese of San Diego purchased a convention center, which they then transformed into a church. They added chapels and rooms, and then decorations were commissioned to adorn those rooms. One commission was granted to a kid in his 20s named John Brockley. His idea had been pretty straightforward. A series of prints showing the greatest hits of the life of Christ, his ascension into the hands of God, and representations of the four Gospels arranged on a proscenium arch. Inspired by the Grünwald Eisenheim altarpiece, John wanted to set his scenes into floating panels that would be mounted to the walls. The pictures would basically become part of the structure of the church. And the Gospels would be represented by animals, large animals with wings. The chapel arch would be adorned with the tetramorph, the angel of St. Matthew, the bull of St. Luke, the lion of St. Mark, and the eagle of St. John. It sounds pretty simple now, as if these things were self-evident and had always existed. But that's not so. There was once a time before the tetramorph, a time before the four evangelists, and there was even a time before that.
Take the old man to the river's mercy, wearing his father's coat and woven pedigree. Take his old thirsty, take his old girl
On that first weekend, John and his girlfriend Marcia piled into his beaten-up truck and drove beneath the leaden marine layer the 50 minutes to Carlsbad. On a foggy morning, they erected ladders in the chapel and measured the walls. John was a little daunted. More than anything, the chapel resembled a poorly decorated dentist's office. The walls were too reflective and bright, the lighting pale and glaring, the industrial carpet was wanting. John wanted to fix all of that. But at the same time, it was a cash gig. He wanted to be in and out. To do the walls and prints, he thought would take him maybe 6 months, perhaps a year, tops. From the church, they drove to Home Depot. In that brightly lit warehouse, he chose 24 by 8 sheets of Luan finished plywood. It was cheap, and he could buy it in large sheets. He figured he could complete the arch with 5 4-foot wide sections. He stacked the sheets of Luan on their edge between the rails of an orange handcart. He combed the dispiriting gray aisles for the tools he would need, a table saw, orbital sander, brushes, and putty knives. Marcia and John loaded the wood and materials into that banged-up blue Toyota truck and returned home. Such a simple sequence of acts, not even worth mentioning. Except in the end, all stories are composed of unremarkable acts. Stepping out from a Home Depot into the bright light of the Southern California sun, that may have been the moment that the work began. In that moment, John had begun to craft the tetramorph. The tetramorph. Such a strange word. In Christian cosmology, the word refers to the four Gospels named for their purported authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These men probably existed, but also perhaps not. Three of the Gospels, those of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, closely resemble one another and could perhaps even be retellings of a foundational text. These are called the Synoptic Gospels. The fourth narrative, the Gospel according to John, is the most idiosyncratic, its language poetic and heartfelt. The Gospels are fundamentally a collection of stories, little bits attributed to the life of Christ. And these few bits that we have infer all the rest. Some stories, like the Annunciation, occur in a single book. Others appear in all of them. But these books don't include everything. There are Apocrypha, Gospels, foundational texts with their own set of narratives, parables, and sayings that have been excluded from the canon. In the end, why some stories and not others? Each of the authors has their own attribute. St. Matthew, the wings of an angel, Luke, the bull, the lion of St. Mark, and the eagle of St. John. But again, why is this so? The most obvious answer is pretty simple. For much of church history, humans couldn't read. Information was relayed orally and through pictures. The early churches were conceived as dimensional libraries in which the stories of the church would be carved into stone, painted, and cast in glass. Until well after the advent of the printing press in the 1400s, congregants could not read the Gospels, but they could look at pictures of the stories and representations of the books and their authors. But that posed another problem. We don't know what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John looked like. At first, they were represented by stylized images of bearded men, but there was no way to distinguish them by their faces in the way, for example, we can instantly tell the difference between Abraham Lincoln or George Washington. So artists distinguished them by signifiers, in this case, animals. But why these animals? What do they mean? One way to understand this might invite us to think about time. Most of us know that in the Western world, we count the supposed year of Christ's birth as year zero. The revelation of God must have signaled a beginning, a true beginning, as if time itself did not exist before his coming. And yet, time did exist before him. We know that. And we don't know when that time started. And so the body of time extends backwards from the moment of Christ infinitely into the past, like negative numbers on an elementary school number line. Except negative numbers haven't always existed. They're a pretty recent idea. They're first developed in China in what the West we know as the year 300 Anno Domini AD, the year of our Lord. And yet, we needed some way to account for the millions, the billions of years that preceded Christ. So, we just threw it under the umbrella of BC, before Christ, and just counted backwards. But this is all kind of a contemporary fiction, because in the time of Christ, there was no year zero. In fact, there may not even have been any years at all. And actually, time may not even have existed for people, at least in the way we conceive of it now. But the comings and goings of the world must have been governed by something. And that something, it turns out, was the tetramorph.
Water ain't clear. Springtime came with a vengeance this year. Come on in, the water's warm down here. High on my habitat flies when you're stuck in a rut and you realize. My on my habitat flies. Come on, baby, won't you dry your eyes?
John and Marcia would load the Luan panels into their truck and haul them up to Carlsbad. That morning, he and Marcia set up a work area in the parking lot and, standing there between the white parking stripes, got to figuring out how they would transfer the dimensions of the arch onto the Luan boards. They once again erected ladders inside the chapel. On the top rung, John measured the angle and interior length of the roof gable. In the parking lot, he set up the panels on sawhorses and stenciled the dimensions on the boards, and then ripped the panels with a skill saw. They carried the panel pieces into the church. Marcia and their friend Anna Owen climbed the ladders. Together, they pressed the top edge of the boards against the ceiling gable and held them against the wall, while John scribed the lower curve of the arch on the back of the panel. They carefully lowered them, descending the ladders, trying not to fall. They carried them back outside, and John cut the curve with the skill saw. Each morning, the three of them would get up early and make the long drive to Carlsbad and would stay the day. They would break for lunch. It took 3 days just to cut and dimension the panels for the back wall and the arch. They returned the boards back to Mission Hills. In his shaded driveway among the aloes, John cut more wood and built frames out of the 2x4s. The tetramorph, the four forms. All things could be described by four forms, the four states of being. Solid, like that of the earth, liquid, like that of water, gaseous or invisible, like that of air. And those things in a state of transmutation, of pure energy, the form of fire. To the first people, these states of matter seemed foundational to the physical world. But what force governed these four things? At night shone points of light, holes in the celestial fabric. The lights weren't static. They moved, and their procession seemed tied to temperature and atmospherics on Earth. When the back wall of the Adoration Chapel was eventually complete, on the rear wall would rise John's conception of the ascending Christ, his head turned upward, surrounded by a golden halo, and in the center, a red Greek cross, accented with the flared ends of the cross of St. John, a golden compass with four cardinal points that references not just the cardinal points of earthly geography, but also the cardinal points of the celestial map, that thing we call the zodiac. The zodiac that we know today belongs to the Greek world, but it in turn originated in the astronomy of the Babylonian, the builders of the Tower of Babel. The great architects had dared to erect a tower that would touch the face of heaven. It is said that they wanted to understand the province of God, and so erected a structure that would elevate them into the sky and protect them from a wrathful flood. The great ziggurat would be struck down because of this hubris. The original zodiac had no dates, only references to points of light in the darkness. Those diamonds observed and treasured by shepherds and poets and insomniacs. The vault slowly wheeled while others slept. But if you had the right presence of mind, you could stay awake and patterns would be revealed. Arrangements of light would appear and transit in regular cycles. The cycles mirrored cycles here on Earth, and since logically the Earth could not govern the celestial vastness, it had to be the other way around. The celestial events predicating our seasonality and the changing of forms here on Earth. We conflated the co-occurrence with causality. We were not the principal actor in the universe, but rather those celestial things in the sky above us.
How long have you felt something? How long has it been? You turn it on and the details come. You say no, no, not again.
John had wanted the panels to have an ochre patina that would feel steeped and old, but he didn't have a solution. One afternoon, he and Marcia went down to the downtown Goodwill to buy some t-shirts and jeans. Outside, men lay on the sidewalk, others dissolutely pushing shopping carts filled with collected junk. John walked down the musty aisles. Racks of discarded vinyl, long rows of worn clothes for resale, shelves of glassware and abandoned revereware and tchotchkes. At the back of the Goodwill, crates of discarded dress patterns. John opened one and unfolded a sheet so thin, 3 feet square, the paper deep golden and mottled. Dotted lines cut to the edges, marking curves, strange patterns of a shape not quite apparent, not of his devising. Strange words, strange simple syllables, dashed lines leading into the infinite. He looked at the hundreds of thick white envelopes of long out-of-fashion dresses, dresses never to be worn, never even to be made. An entire universe of patterns that would never greet the human eye. Patterns ugly, patterns quaint, patterns longing for fabric. But what John liked most about them was the color and the texture of the paper. It was parchment. Parchment like the leaves of a scroll or an ancient text waiting to be deciphered. John could buy them for pennies. He loaded up plastic bags with the pattern envelopes. The paper was cheap, yes, but what John didn't know was that he would be bound to those patterns for the next several years of his life. At the beginning of the Egyptian New Year, the star Sirius would appear on the horizon to the east of the Nile. When that red glowing point appeared, the people of the river knew that a tide of water would be unleashed upon them. Flowing from the south, the water came from a place beyond the known world, and it would flood the Nile Delta. In the Osiris rituals, the rituals of rebirth, dormant seeds would be buried in the black earth, returned to the underworld, and as they came to life once again and emerged from the ground, their resurrection would be celebrated. As far as the eye could see would stretch a green carpet of iron corn and emmer wheat. In the spring, thousands of people would harvest the grain, so much that the stored calories would feed the Mediterranean world. Bread, the flesh of Osiris, would be ritually dismembered and parted among people. The grain was so vital, and in turn so vital were the life-giving waters, that among the first scientist priests were those who observed the heavens so closely that they could chart and predict the rising of Sirius. In the Babylonian zodiac, the bull, the lion, the eagle, and the angel water-bearer marked the four contrapuntal points of the sky, and their appearances in the Middle Eastern vault signaled changes on earth. With the lion came the heat of summer, with the eagle the winds, and the angel water sign brought season of rain. Planets would transit among those constellations. The four quarters of the zodiac appeared as the four beasts in the book of Ezekiel in the Hebrew Bible, in which God's chariot was drawn by four living creatures, each having four faces, those of a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle, and four wings. Beside each living creature turned a wheel within a wheel. In the zodiac, each quadrant could in turn be divided into three, totaling 12, the 12 parties of heaven that could hold and describe an actual and metaphorical universe. The constellations wheeled in the sky like a mill wheel, that great dispassionate wheel of time, grinding our beings into sacrificial flour. The tetramorph, day and night without ceasing, they sang, "Holy, holy, the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and is to come." In John's chapel, we perceive Christ's passion, not through the written word, but through the tetramorph, that great wheel of time, the arbiter of all death. Were stacked against the garage walls. Such cold morning. John opened up a can of milky chalk gesso. He dipped his brush and slowly applied the gesso to the Luan plywood. He drank his coffee. On the radio, Howard Stern asked women whether their tits were real. He asked them to take their tops off to prove it. Panel by panel, John applied the white gesso. The morning sun became then midday sun and then afternoon sun. John let the gesso dry. The next morning, cold morning, John dipped his brush in the white gesso and applied a second coat. Howard Stern, vulgar. Howard Stern, profane. Late afternoon, John let the second coat of gesso dry. A few days later, John applied a base coat of white oil paint. He inhaled the sticky turpentine fumes. He worked slowly. He'd have to wait for each panel to dry before it could be moved. And then he would paint the next one. Hummingbirds in a nest, the babies the size of a fingernail. The oil dries. John smokes a cigarette. He sits for an hour, watching the hummingbird flit from blossom to blossom and then hover above the nest, wings beating in a blur as she fed her young. Days pass. John lays down another coat of oil. Howard Stern continues his talking. The oil goes on smoothly like silk, panel after panel. The oil's dry. Days pass, sun rising, sunsets, some days rain. For days, John sands each panel by hand, polishing the surface with fine grit sandpaper until they are glossy smooth. Nighttime. John had picked up the art books in thrift stores, others on loan from the San Diego State Library. He sits inside the converted garage, paging through the images, thousands of years of ecclesiastic art. He drinks Heineken's, Byzantine mosaics, gold, ceiling of Saint Sophia, the church of Saint Cluny, medieval abbeys. He makes choices. He tries to understand the choices that others had made. Why does one choose this thing and not another? We're taught in Sunday school that the pagan animistic world changed with Christ's advent. In the years following his arrival, his emissaries would fan across the globe, agents of a tide of conversion that would usher us from a polytheistic, multivariate belief system to a monotheism, one true God, one ring to rule them all. And yet the zodiac persisted in the Christian tetramorph. But this poses another, perhaps more arcane problem. Transforming a living, breathing, sentient creature into a totem is a form of dominion. The actual animal becomes a servant to a concept. When we transform an animal into a symbol, we deny the animal sentience and its own prerogatives. You might consider it an abstracted form of violence. And that was perhaps John's biggest problem. I don't think he really cared about the origins of the tetramorph or the intricacies of Chaldean astronomy. It was all just human blather. It was our thing. For John, he wanted simply to honor the animals. There is the lion that stalked the plains of North Africa, and then there is the lion that appears in Revelations. There is the symbol of the Paschal lamb. And then there is the actual spring lamb, not as metaphor, but as the true and living lamb bleating, eyes wild with fear, as it is wrested from its mother's teat and pinned to the ground and a metal blade drawn across its neck in what, in a just world, would only be seen as an unjust end. Perhaps ritual evolved to provide moral justification for supremely immoral acts. The fallen swallow lying dead on the sidewalk pavement, the dove alit upon the branch of the jacaranda tree outside John's window. Perhaps we dishonor and profane these living things with our adulterated and incomplete conceptions of. Are the actual lion and the actual oxen and the actual sparrow in any need of the Lamb of God? Within Christianity, the very idea of God privileges us over all other life. There is no giraffe or lemur Jesus. God revealed himself in the form of a man, at which point things really begin to crumble. What moral being would create an intermediary that would destroy the rest of creation itself and execute other creatures is a form of worship. I think John was kind of done with that. So he decided to put big animals on the wall. And he wanted them to have wings. He wanted it to feel pagan. But he didn't want them to just be totems. He wanted them to be more true than that. In much of ecclesiastic art, the lion and bull and eagle are cartoonish, as if the artist had never even seen the real thing, or that they perhaps lack the skill to accurately draw them, or perhaps both. John would make his animals anatomically correct and, to the best of his ability, spare any overlay. To the extent that any representation can be, he wanted these representations to be true unto them. In John's private audience with God, he was attempting a sleight of hand. He brought God's other creatures into the chapel of adoration. The apostate revolts against God, even the very idea of God. The composition and fabrication of the back wall of the adoration chapel, conceived as a 6-month project, would in the end take 3 years. And in that time, John both honored and defected from God. Or perhaps it was the opposite. Perhaps he defected from the church to better align himself with God. As if to say that Christianity is still an animist religion, that beneath years of ecclesiastic writing and disputation and uncountable images and narratives, that the story of Christ, well, it may not really be that different than the worshiping of the resurrection of life in the Egyptian cult of Osiris. But here's the thing. Just saying those words, it's heresy. So this story I'm telling may have a pretty short shelf life. It may only be a matter of time before some evangelical doxes and terrorizes me, or perhaps I'll be persecuted by a squad of church scholars far more learned than myself. And others have most certainly already turned this off because it's just too Christian. Like, you just wanted to hear some stories about San Diego, and now I'm talking about God, and you don't want nothing to do with Jesus. Or perhaps, even more likely, most everyone simply won't care. It's just too much for a Friday afternoon, and you'll quit listening. And then I'll be relegated to some purgatory of non-existence. Those scenarios are what they are. The most honest thing might simply be to accept that fate. The fate of street corner evangelists, those people fevered with the spirit, who fill the air and public spaces with their rantings, telling stories that are of hardly any interest to those hurriedly passing by in this fleeting world. This is Andrew Lewis, and welcome back to the second season of The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. If you're just joining us, I encourage you to listen to the previous episodes so that you know what this is all about. You can find them on KOWS on the Mountain page, or if you want, you can go to Spotify and stream them. Just search for The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. I also encourage you to subscribe to the Substack. Just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and it should come up. If you subscribe, I'll be able to keep you informed on what's cooking in Mountainland. Today's songs are Rex's Blues by Townes Van Zandt, Red, Black, and White, sung by Jessica Hoop, Lay Your Head Down by Carolyn Story, The Daily News by Anna Ash, Thinking About You by O.C. Eliot, Golden Age by Chris Staples, and On Your Wing, sung by Iron and Wine. We'll be stepping out, hopefully if we have enough time, to I Hear Them All by Old Crow Medicine Show. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time and attention. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen and it makes your world a little bigger, consider sharing with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
Crying of the hungry in the deserts where they're wandering. Hear them crying out for heaven's own benevolence upon them. Hear destructive power prevailing. I hear fools falsely hailing to the crooked wits of tyrants when they call. I hear them all, I hear them all, I hear them all. I hear the sounds of tearing pages and the roar of burning paper. All the crimes and acquisition turn to air and ash and vapor. And the rattle of the shackle far beyond emancipators. And the lowliest to gather in their stalls. I hear them all, I hear them all, I hear them all. Dixie, with your money and your power, I can hear the flowers growing in the rubble of the towers. I hear leaders quit their lying. I hear babies quit their crying. I hear soldiers quit their dying, one and all. I hear them all.